welcome to the start of a new occasional series on All About Jack. All About Jack is a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty, author of C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell, a companion and study guide to the Screwtape Letters. And actually, this special feature is something I've already began last year, but since then I've re-envisioned it. Let me explain. Previously, I had done what I called anniversary shows on a couple of Lewis's works. They were the Screwtape Letters and the essay The Weight of Glory that was first a sermon. Each had some type of 75th anniversary in 2016, and you can follow the link in the show notes to hear those episodes to learn more about each of them. Well, as a result of those shows, I thought it would be beneficial to do something similar to all of Lewis's works, but focusing on just the books only. After all, I already do an occasional essay chat series, so unless there is a major exception, this series will only focus on entire books from or edited by C.S. Lewis. The challenge then became how to decide which book to do when. I thought I'd do the same anniversary approach. However, that became somewhat complicated, and so I'm going to just do a show on a particular book whenever I have between 3 and 5 individuals recorded on a specific book. I decided to call this series Why Read C.S. Lewis, because a key reason for what I'm doing is to get you to read the works of C.S. Lewis firsthand, or to reread a book by Lewis that you previously enjoyed. While most of the people you will hear on the show are established scholars, some will be individuals like myself who are not teachers, but well-versed in Lewis's works to be considered either an enthusiast or emerging scholar. In the regular series, up to 5 people again will share about just one work from Lewis. Those individuals were told to, in a sense, give testimony to the book and could choose among the following prompts or take another approach to talk about the book. They could tell why the work is important to read, what it meant to them, what stood out when they first read it, what they learned the last time they read it, and/or why others should read or reread the book. In this episode, however, I'm not going to present just one book, but 6. That is, I'm introducing this occasional series by sharing an example of what the shows will be like. To do that, I'm sharing comments about 6 different books from 6 different people. In most cases, it is actually not all of what they had to say about the particular work, so you can look forward to hearing more comments from them when I release the actual show on that individual book. The books mentioned today are as follows in this order: The Last Battle, The Great Divorce, Till We Have Faces, Dimer, The Allegory of Love, and finally, Studies in Medieval and Renaissance Literature. And then the final thing to say before letting you hear comments about those books is to let you know who you will be hearing from. First, I'll be sharing about 60% of what Dr. Michael Ward had to say about The Last Battle. Then about half of what Britton Dickinson had to say about The Great Divorce will come next. This will be followed by a summary of Dimer by Dr. Crystal Hurd. After that, you'll hear just about more than half of the thoughts Dr. Jerry Root made on The Allegory of Love. And finally, I'm sharing also around 50% of Mark Neal's reflections on Studies in Medieval and Renaissance Literature. At the end, I'll give you details about each of the speakers. First up again is Dr. Michael Ward.
There are 2 main things I would say about The Last Battle. One has to do with what Lewis says about the Chronicles of Narnia in general being about Christ. All the Narnia series is about Christ, he says. So how is The Last Battle about Christ? And secondly, I would want to say something about my belief that the Narnia Chronicles are structured according to the symbolism of the 7 heavens, which I've written about in my book Planet Narnia. So first of all, Christ. How is The Last Battle about Christ. Lewis says the whole Narnia series is about Christ, but in The Last Battle, his Christ character of Aslan doesn't show up at all for the first three quarters of the book or so. He's absent. He's nowhere to be seen. In fact, insofar as he is discernible, he's said to have changed, so that he's now in favour of putting the talking beasts under the yoke and felling the talking trees, and he's visible only at night when he comes out of this stable lit by a bonfire, and it's all frightening and cold and dark and mysterious, and his name is no longer Aslan, but now Tashlan. It's all very scary, very apocalyptic, and indeed, of course, what Lewis is trying to depict here is not actually Christ, but the Antichrist, the deceiver who would deceive the very elect, as per the apocalyptic parts of the Bible. So where is the real Christ? That's the mysterious thing about The Last Battle. And I think what Lewis is trying to do here is to show us an aspect of Christ's own nature, but in a very indirect and implicit kind of fashion. Where I would suggest people look for that is in that episode when King Tyrion, the last of the kings of Narnia, is bound to the tree. We might miss the connection here with the cross of Christ, because Tyrion is bound with his hands by his side. He's not attached to the tree in a cruciform position. But if you look at the way Lewis talks about this passage, there are lots of little echoes of Calvary. You know, the darkness, the cold, the way that the animals come and tend him, with an echo there of Psalm 22, and they put up a little sponge to his lips, just as the sponge of vinegar is put up to Jesus's lips on the hyssop stick. But most of all, I would want to draw attention to Tyrion's desperate prayer that he cries out in the darkness. He says, "Aslan, Aslan, Aslan, come and help us now." But the darkness and the cold and the quietness went on just the same. And I think that's Lewis's version of Jesus's own cry from the cross. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? Which we find in both Matthew's Gospel and Mark's. And that cry of dereliction, as it's called, is the one verse from the scripture that you find in Lewis's work more often than any other, I think. I've counted over 20 appearances of that cry from the cross in Lewis's writings, and it's all over his work, from his diary, his poetry, his fiction, his apologetics, his journalism, his literary criticism, his letter writing, and so on and so forth. And he was even interested in this verse before he became a Christian. There are two appearances, you know, before he's even a Christian. So I think that's what we are meant to hear echoing in Tyrion's cry from the tree. He calls out and nothing happens, just like Jesus calls out, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Christ feels abandoned. Where is God, the Father, to Jesus himself at this moment of dereliction? But in spite of that desolation that Tyrion experiences, he maintains his faith. He persists with his prayer and he goes on and says, let me be killed. I ask nothing for myself, but come and save all Narnia. And still there was no change in the night or the wood, but there began to be a kind of change inside Tyrion. Without knowing why, he began to feel a faint hope, and he felt somehow stronger. So I think that's an indication that although Aslan appears to be absent, he's not actually absent. He is strengthening Tyrion from within. Somehow, this faint hope is growing in him. He can't explain it, he can't account for it, but he felt somehow stronger. Just as Jesus on the cross set his face like flint and despised the cross, enduring the shame for the joy that was set before him. And he goes through with his sacrifice for the sake of the salvation of the world, even though he can't feel any sensible consolation from his heavenly Father. So I think this is how we are to find Aslan present in the first three quarters of The Last Battle. He's present to those with the eye of faith. They can't see him externally. He's not showing up in person, but they've got to dig deep into their own belief, into their own faith, and they will find Aslan they will see him with the eyes of their heart, so to speak. It's a great test of faith. And this is where I would segue into the second point I want to make about Sam.
Here's Britton Dickinson.
One of my hopes for The Great Divorce is that it will become a Cinderella story of C.S. Lewis's works. It's certainly not his most popular. It's not where people go when they want to move from his fiction like Narnia or the science fiction work into some of his more serious or Christian or theological work. But I actually think it should come back up to the front of that conversation. And I would actually encourage people to read it before they read Mere Christianity, which is kind of like an apologetics work, or his essays, which are really like cultural criticism. Perhaps I'm being a bit selfish in this. I love The Great Divorce. It was really the first book I came to as an adult after having failed to kind of read Mere Christianity and after having loved Narnia as a kid, but not returned to it as an adult. And so I found so much benefit from this. And I also had the chance to read it in a different culture as I was working overseas, living in Japan. And we used it. I didn't even assign it, but somebody else assigned it. We used it as a teaching tool for English, for advanced English learning. It's a bit of a British book, but it gives an international language, and a lot of our teachers are American and Canadian, so it was a way of rounding that out. And each week we read a few paragraphs of The Great Divorce, and so I got to see this book just inches away from my face, right up close, so that I could look at it word by word and line by line and define it and to think about it in that very close reading kind of a way. And so for me, it's always been a fascinating book. And I probably read it once a year. Occasionally, I've read it twice. And so I hope that this will become a recovery book. But what draws me to it isn't just the fact that I had a great experience reading it. This actually is a book that grows richer for me each time I read it, including a little bit of frustration that I have with it. What I love about the book is that it comes out in a context where people were writing philosophical novellas. So these are books that are about as long as The Great Divorce, but are there to draw out a kind of conversational moment. And so this is a great period for these kinds of books, like Jean-Paul Sartre's Nausea or Albert Camus' The Stranger or The Outsider, it might be called. And so C.S. Lewis, whether he knew it or not, is writing into a tradition where people take a shorter story and they try out an idea. And here Lewis tries out a pretty brilliant idea, which is the question of what would happen if you got a chance to visit heaven? Would you want to stay? Our immediate answer is always, well, yes. Well, but that's probably the heaven that comes from our Hollywood films or even worse, from our hymn book. It's not the kind of heaven that Lewis introduces. Lewis introduces us to the heaven of his imagination. And so it's a dangerous heaven, a place where reality is just too much. It's too difficult for us to cope with. The sun is too bright. The grass is too hard. The wind threatens to tear us apart like a dry leaf in fall. And so The Great Divorce draws us into this rich imaginative landscape that I think is actually among Lewis's best. So I actually put The Great Divorce when it comes to describing context and telling the story of the landscape and the use of poetic beauty, I actually put this up with Till We Have Faces and The Paralandra. For me, The Great Divorce is right up there when it comes to the language. And in this book, he gets to try out, as philosophical novellas do, he gets to try out an idea.
Next, Serena Higgins.
I would say that the most powerful element of Till We Have Faces for me is that it was the first book I ever encountered that presented a mythic view of Christianity. Or not only a mythic view, but it showed Christianity with the power and the beauty and the memorability of a very great myth. Now, this is one of the things that C.S. Lewis had to grow into throughout his own life. At first, he didn't like Christianity because it didn't appeal to his imagination the way the great Greek, Roman, and Norse myths did. But he came to see that it had that same mythic power with the dying and rising God and the cycles of the seasons and the longing that humans have to be united with the divine. So this was the first book that raised Christianity to that level and really got under my skin and into my heart about those mythic elements. But see, Lewis doesn't do that in any sort of a dogmatic way here at all. And that's the other thing that I love about this book. He creates a consistent secondary world, which is an ancient civilization during the time of ancient Greece, but it's a little kingdom on the margins of the empire. And he stays within that secondary world for the entire book. So that's what amazed me, too, from a literary point of view, was that he never stepped outside the book to say, oh, and by the way, this is sort of a parable about Christianity. No, instead, he just showed a story about faith and doubt and spiritual terror, spiritual longing, and the answer to all of the questions and the doubts that we have. But he showed those in an ancient myth. Now, there might be one tiny way he slips out of that frame at the end, but I'll let you see when you get to the end yourself whether you think maybe he steps outside of that a little bit. There are a few other elements that are woven through this book that are related to what I've already said about the mythic power and the consistent secondary world that are really just beautifully well done until we have faces. One is the main character's perspective. How many other middle-aged or even elderly male authors do you know who write their greatest novel from the first-person point of view of a woman, and a woman who is known for being very unattractive at that? It's an unusual perspective for a novel in any case, and especially for a male author. And I also think that that is a very, very consistent part of the world that Lewis creates. He really shows us a particular feminine psychology in a profound, detailed, and sensitive way. And of course, in this, his wife, Joy Davidman, was very influential in helping him to learn how to write that way. So it's valuable from the perspective. And then my favorite theme throughout all of Lewis's writing is the idea of joy, or Sehnsucht, which is a very particular kind of longing that he felt all throughout his life. He would get these sort of flashes of yearning when he was a child, in nature or in poetry or music especially. And he weaves that into the story in a beautiful, embodied way. So the reader can experience it too. The characters are feeling these longings when they listen to certain poetry or songs, or when they look at this mountain in the distance and feel a desire to go there. And this all connects to the great revelation that comes at the end of the book. So those are some of the very specific elements that I love, as well as the literary skill that's deployed in it. And also, as Lewis's last novel, this is a work that weaves together most of the themes that are important in all of his other books. So perspectives like contemplation versus enjoyment, which is an important theme about being inside something to experience it versus being outside something to analyze it. So that's an important theme. He also deals with what he calls thick and clear religions, which are, to sort of oversimplify it, religions of the body and religions of the mind. And the character comes to realize that both of these are absolutely necessary. And in an essay, Lewis says that Christianity is the only religion that contains both of these. But again, I just...
Dr. Crystal Hurd.
In summary, Dimer chronicles the tale of a young man who meets a mysterious young woman who mates with her and creates a monster. The monster eventually kills Dimer and becomes a god. The original version was written in prose in 1916 when Lewis was 18 years old. Later, in 1922, he would return to the idea and restructure it as a narrative poem. Its first title was The Redemption of Ask. Ask being the name of the Adam figure in the creation myth of Norse mythology. The poem would be published 3 years later as Dimer and, quote, found some good reviews and almost no readers, according to Lewis. The poem is composed in rhyme royal septets, utilizing an A-B-A-B-B-C-C rhyme scheme throughout. This form was previously used by many poets, including Chaucer, Edmund Spenser, Shakespeare, and William Wordsworth, among others. I think one of the most interesting things about Dimer is that it's essentially a political poem. Lewis himself admits that its origins come from political leanings and persuasions of his youth. The poem was written while Lewis was still an atheist, and while he was caught up in the conflicts of the early 20th century, as well as the ideals of the age. Of this poem, Lewis wrote, "In those days, the new psychology was just beginning to make itself felt in the circles I most frequented at Oxford. This joined forces with the fact that we felt ourselves, as young men always do, to be escaping from the illusions of adolescence. And as a result, we were much exercised about the problem of fantasy or wishful thinking. The Christina dream, as we called it, after Christina Pontifex in Butler's novel, was the hidden enemy whom we all determined to unmask and defeat. My hero, therefore, had to be a man who had succumbed to his allurements and finally got the better of them. The magician in the poem is modeled after William Butler Yeats, whom Lewis visited twice during his early years at Oxford, and who seemed obsessed with fantasy and magic. Dimer rebels against the totalitarian state and indulges in what Lewis calls anarchism. He writes, quote, "I put into it my hatred of my public school and my recent hatred of the army," unquote. In it are echoes of early and impressionable works like Wagner's Siegfried and The Twilight of the Gods, and historical events such as World War I and the Russian Revolution. This is reflected in the verse. "There is a city which men call in scorn the perfect city, eastward of this wood. You've heard about the place. There I was born. I'm one of them. Their work, their sober mood, the ordered life, the laws are in my blood. A life, well, less than happy, something more than the red greed and lust that went before."
Dr. Jerry Root is next.
The Allegory of Love is one of the books few people read that Lewis wrote, unless they feel they're coerced to read it in some sort of a medieval course in college or graduate school. And that's unfortunate, because it's actually one of the most important books he wrote. This is the book that one literary critic said in the late 1900s changed the entire discipline of medieval studies. If a person is an academic and they write a book and nobody reviews it, it's the curse of death. If they review it and it's a negative review, at least they were taken seriously. If they give it a positive review, that's frosting on the cake. But when it changes the way a person looks at a discipline, this is remarkable, and that's what the Allegory of Love did. Lewis looked at the whole issue of the love allegory as it was developed over centuries in the Middle Ages. He sees those things that contributed to the love allegory. He sees where it was going through the Middle Ages, and he sees the zenith of its expression in Spenser's Faerie Queen. But first off, some concepts relative to the allegory of love. Lewis begins the book by saying humanity does not pass through phases as a train passes through stations. Being alive, it has the privilege of always moving, yet never leaving anything behind. Whatever we have been, in some sort, we are still. Lewis acknowledges debts to the past, but he also sees there's continuity and change. Sometimes there's change of kind. We have to reject a conceptual framework that's no longer responsive to incoming data. Or there could be change of degree, just as a tree doesn't have to give up its interior rings just because it adds more. If it's not adding more, it's soon dead. And so Lewis again emphasizes this big idea in his writing: reality is iconoclastic. Nevertheless, as he studies the idea of courtly love, he reminds the reader of these shocking characteristics of courtly love. Number one, it was characterized by humility. That's not shocking. That's great. Humility is a boon to any age that would look honestly at things. Courtesy, the high courtesy of heaven, particularly, "I offer my life for you." And also there was the religion of love, the lover's obedience and service of love to the beloved. But the fourth characteristic was a characteristic of adultery. This doesn't seem to us to be proper to courtly love, but it was, because in the day when these love allegories were first developed, in fact, one didn't marry his or her beloved. The marriages were arranged, and usually the passions were directed towards somebody one wasn't married to, maybe even one was prevented from marrying. And so consequently, so much of the medieval allegory has this adultery feature at play. And Lewis develops this. He sees it in books like The Romance of the Rose by Guillaume Delory, which is itself a great read. People may want to go read these books when they encounter them in Lewis, as Mark Neal often says, Lewis even says, we shall understand our present. Consequently, this is the great achievement of the love allegory when it moves in this direction. When you think about it, this is a book that's published in 1936. Some bits and pieces of Lewis had begun even before he was a Christian. But I think there must have been an excitement in his heart as he began to see his Christianity, even in the literature of the age that he dedicated his adult life into studying, that in this literature, it saw the integration of faith in that whole process of learning and saw the integration of faith even in the concept of a love allegory. And I think it must have affirmed for him all the more his own wisdom in making the decision to be a follower of Christ and a lover of Christ. And so I think, again, The Allegory of Love, which is a book far too complex to describe in the brief moments we have now, is a book that every Lewis lover has incomplete knowledge of Lewis until they have learned to steep themselves in this particular book. And I would encourage people to read it.
And finally, Mark Neal.
Studies in Medieval and Renaissance Literature is a collection of essays on a number of diverse topics, like the medieval cosmology, similes in Dante's Divine Comedy, and essays on the British poet Edmund Spenser and his epic poem, The Faerie Queen. In fact, the book is composed really almost entirely of essays on Dante and Spenser, which gives you an idea of how much Lewis valued these guys. And for Lewis, I think these were the artistic giants of the medieval age. And actually, a number of these essays in this collection were meant to be the beginnings of books, which Lewis never got around to writing. I think that much of Lewis's literary work was written, as he says himself, to cure errors of misapprehension and to act as a guide to a particular work that we might know something of the time in which the author was writing, so that we would be better able to use what Lewis calls the historical imagination. The historical imagination enables us to place ourselves in the world of the story rather than bringing our modern worldview and sensibilities to bear on that story in a way that would likely create a different work than the author intended. And I think this is partly why Lewis wrote The Discarded Image, to enable people to read works of the medieval period with a greater understanding. In Studies in Medieval and Renaissance Literature, Lewis writes this. He says, when our aim is knowledge, we must go as far as all available means, including the most intense yet at the same time most sternly disciplined exercise of our imaginations, can possibly take us. We want to know, therefore, as far as may be, we want to live through for ourselves the experience of men long dead. And Lewis writes the essays in this book and others of his works to help us get there. But think about that statement for a second, the most intense and sternly disciplined exercise of our imagination. What does Lewis mean by this? I think it gives us an understanding of what Lewis really valued when he read works of literature, the idea of being able to see the world through others' eyes, which he writes about at the end of An Experiment in Criticism. He says, my own eyes are not enough for me. I would see what others have seen. Even that's not enough. I would see what others have imagined. Even that's not enough. I regret that the brutes cannot write books. Gladly would I see how reality is perceived to the eye of a bee, or how it comes charged to the olfactory sense of a dog. And so Lewis has this very broad idea that we must see with others' eyes, and we're confined in this very narrow prison of self. So in this book, he writes of two ways of enjoying the past, what I've called the historical imagination, and he likens it to two ways of enjoying travel. So he describes an English traveler, and he says that this particular man takes his Englishry abroad and comes back with it unchanged. He mixes with other English tourists. He stays at hotels that to him appear to be English hotels. Lewis says that in the same way we can carry our modernity with us through all of our reading, preserving it intact. And then he outlines a second way that we can enjoy the past.
And with that, we conclude the introduction to my new series, focusing on promoting reading works by Lewis firsthand. This, again, will be an occasional feature I'm calling Why Read Lewis. I'm William O'Flaherty from EssentialCSLewis.com and the author of C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell, A Companion and Study Guide to the Screwtape Letters. Be sure to check out my other podcast on All About Jack, either at EssentialCSLewis.com or where the audio files are hosted directly at allaboutjack.podbean.com. There you can also find any links related to the show you're listening to, as well as a link to related episodes. Plus, you'll also find a link to be able to purchase my book, C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell, which is a great way to help support this free podcast. As promised, here's details about the speakers featured on today's show, and I'll also have a link to any of them who have their own website. Dr. Michael Ward, who shared on The Last Battle, is a fellow of Blackfriars Hall, University of Oxford, and professor of apologetics at Houston Baptist University. He's the author of Planet Narnia and The Narnia Code. He also recently co-edited C.S. Lewis at Poets' Corner. His website is michaelward.net. Britton Dickinson is a university lecturer from Canada. You can find him online at apilgriminnarnia.com. He shared comments about The Great Divorce. Serena Higgins was next. She shared thoughts about Till We Have Faces. She is a PhD candidate in British Modernism, teacher of record, and presidential scholar at Baylor University. Among other things, she specializes in the works of Charles Williams and blogs at the Otis Inkling. Dr. Crystal Hurd shared her thoughts on Dimer. She is an educator from Virginia and author of 30 Days with C.S. Lewis, a women's devotional. Her website is crystalhurd.com. Dr. Jerry Root is professor of evangelism at Wheaton College, and he is the co-editor of the best-selling The Quotable Lewis and co-author of The Surprising Imagination of C.S. Lewis. He shared his thoughts on The Allegory of Love. And closing out the program, sharing thoughts about studies in medieval and Renaissance literature, a collection of essays, was Mark Neal. He is the vice president of digital marketing at a Chicago-based marketing firm and co-author of The Surprising Imagination of C.S. Lewis. His website is markneal.org. Again, I'm William O'Flaherty. Thanks again for listening to All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com.